started back. I know it looks like we're missing a few. I know we're supposed to be missing some that are flipping to OB for this afternoon. So that is taken care of. So we do have that that we're going to be doing. So I'm going to go ahead and pick up where I left off. Again, we're still following your handout. Kind of pretty much, if some information I'm just going to let you review or refresh, but let me go ahead and start sharing. I see people are still popping in, and I know Miss Wood will be getting attendance from everybody for this afternoon as well. So, recording is on. So, as I said, we're going to pick up where we left off. We're still talking about foundations of pediatrics. We left off as far as under health supervision, and you should have the corrected page. Sorry.
Are you? Okay, good to see you.
I meant to put the corrected page on my copy. I did on the one online. So health supervision is, it's chapter 31. And it starts on, starts on page 1081. So all my little paper says is one. So I'll say 1081 is where it starts. So that's where the chapter is. Again, we're not going to focus on every little thing in this chapter because there's a whole lot of information in here. I would advise you to look at the chapter, and if you haven't looked at your chapters beforehand, it's really important. So like in this health supervision chapter, it's they have these little blocks that say take note. So if I were you, I would go back in there and look through those little blocks in some of these chapters as far as under the take note box, because like I said, there's a lot of information and there's no way to test you on all of it. And there's no way for you to learn all of it to be tested on. And again, but if you would look at the take note, it'll tell you or give you some tips for that to increase cooperation during screening, set up a reward system. So it's just got some little bitty tidbits in there. Excuse me. That can be very, very beneficial. So I would advise you to pay attention to those or to go back and look at those if you still have some questions. But anyway, so let's get started. Chapter 31, Health Supervision. It is on page 1081, or it starts on page 1081 in your book. Some of those things down. So, principles of health supervision, it focuses on health, not illness, and it's important that we be very proactive in this endeavor. So, we want to provide services proactively. We want to optimize their level of functioning, ensure they're growing and developing appropriately. Growth and development are crucial, and that's one of the difficulties students sometimes encounter in PEDS. Because when we're dealing with adults, we have adulthood, we have early adulthood, adulthood, and older adults. So you don't have the stages of development. We're going to talk about some of that this afternoon later on. You don't have all the stages of growth and development to focus on like you do, because kids are changing very, very rapidly. They're different as a from infancy to toddler, from toddler to preschool. And so we're seeing this evolution and they're in a different stage of development or in growth and development. So we have to focus on that. It's important we prevent injury and illness, and we do that through teaching or through child teaching, parent teaching. Something very minor, I think, perhaps, is like childproofing their home or your home. So we think about especially our toddlers, our kids that are more ambulatory and they're more able to get into things. We think about childproofing the home, and it's very important to childproof the home. And we think about using like the little outlet plugs and everything so they won't stick themselves, their fingers or any toy or anything in the outlet. So we think about that. How many of you have ever thought about, though, when you're childproofing your home, to go around your house at their level? So if you're on your hands and knees or if you're down at their level, you're going to see what they see, and you can see potential dangers or potential problems to their safety by doing that. So think about that. Primary components, again, it's listed in your handout, developmental surveillance and screening. Anytime a child has a pediatrician visit or a clinic visit or anything like that, we are measuring or monitoring their growth, how they've changed in their length or their height, how they've changed in their weight, or have they changed in their weight. These things are plotted on a growth and development chart, and those charts were found in the back of your book, and they might still be. But we need to plot their growth and development. And those are things we're looking at. We're also assessing their milestones. Are they accomplishing things that they're supposed to do, those developmental milestones? Are they able to? And there's a whole list of things, you know, are they able to use a pincher grasp, or are they able to say some words like mama, dada? Are they pulling to a sitting position? Are they pulling up? Those types of things are developmental milestones. And those are the things that we're assessing as part of their screening. Another important component of that is injury and disease prevention. And we need to think about health promotion. So healthy habits, things for healthy habits, healthy behaviors, things that we need to do or encourage in regards to that. There are different types of screening. We can screen for risk assessment. And it's looking at objective and subjective data to determine whether they're going to develop a particular condition. We can do a universal screening, or we screen the entire population, regardless of their individual risk. We can do selective screening. When a risk assessment indicates that there's one or more risk factors for a particular disorder, there are different types of screenings that are performed. Metabolic screening, hearing screening, vision, iron deficiency anemia, very important. Lead, another very important one. Hypertension and hyperlipidemia. Know these screenings. These are found in your book, 1088 to 1094, the particular screenings. Know the different screenings. And again, utilize those little yellow boxes because they'll give you clues or tips. Any child who loses a developmental milestone, that's as important as whether they've attained one. If they were able to do something and now they can't, why can't they? What's the problem that we have as a result? So you get little hints and whatever, as well as having all different screening tools that are in there. We're not going to focus in the specifics, but you'll get some more of those in or when you discuss some of the growth and development things as far as what they should be able or shouldn't be able to do. Okay, next up is immunizations, and that's on page 1094. Immunizations are, in my estimation, vital. They're very, very important. Again, we're shifting from treatment of disease to prevention of disease. And that, of course, came about in the 40s, but That is what our focus is, or what we should be mindful of. We vaccinate kids smallpox, tetanus, or Tdap, tetanus, diphtheria, pertussis. We vaccinate against measles, mumps, rubella. We do varicella. We do polio. We do hepatitis. We do flu. We do pneumonia. We do meningitis. We do rotavirus. We do HPV, the Gardasil. We give that to boys and girls for the HPV. So there are a lot of different vaccinations that we do. And lovely that the immune system that we have, it can recognize stuff in your body or different things in your body as self or non-self. And then again, it's just a definition of antigens. Foreign materials in your body are antigens. When the body recognizes that, the body produces an antibody to go and destroy and remove the antigen. So antibodies, antigens, again, this is a little bit of patho, physiology. We don't really test on that, but you do need an understanding of what's going on in the body and what we're doing when we vaccinate. Different types of immunity. You can have active immunity. You can have passive immunity. And so passive immunity is that's when they produce when the immunoglobulins of one person are transferred to another, typically from mothers to infants via colostrum or the placenta. Passive immunity is short term, and we're dealing with weeks or months. I think you get passive immunity from at birth from the mom first 4 months, maybe. Don't quote me on it.
That's about right.
I thought it was. Then active immunity is when your body, your own body, generates that immune response and gives you long-term protection. And again, that's why we use vaccines. The body will remember the antigen and they'll keep fighting it, or your body will keep fighting it. So that's the wonderful thing about our immunities. There are different types of vaccines. There's a live attenuated vaccine. There's a killed virus vaccine. It's incapable of reproducing, but it produces an immune response. There are toxoid vaccines, conjugate vaccines, recombinant vaccines. These are all the different types of vaccines. That's on page 1095. Just kind of FYI. We do DTaP when they're younger than 7, diphtheria, tetanus, and acellular pertussis. We do the Tdap when they're older than 7, and that's tetanus, diphtheria, and acellular pertussis. We have seen a resurgence of pertussis, and there was some thought that the vaccine, that they required a booster, that the vaccine was wearing off with numbers of years. So anyway, but we typically will do the DTaP. You can do Haemophilus influenza type B or Hib. Polio, which is IPV and inactivated polio vaccine. So we do polio. We do MMR. We do Hep A, Hep B, varicella, pneumococcal. And there's a different schedule as far as pneumococcal and influenza, rotavirus, HPV, and meningococcal. And you do have a vaccination schedule. I'm not going to go into the particulars about when you receive or what age are you when you receive your vaccines. The lovely thing now is that a lot of our vaccines are combined. So you're giving them one injection and you're covering more than one illness. And that makes it a lot better as far as numbers of shots that we're giving. Our typical 2, 4, and 6 months old, they receive the rotavirus vaccine, which is an oral vaccine, which is pretty cool. and they also receive their DTaP. And I think what else? Hep A. Is it Hep A? And Hib, or a combination of those. So they're receiving three injections and one oral vaccine at 2, 4, and 6 months, unless we're in flu season, and they might also receive the flu vaccine, which is another injection. So pay attention to your vaccination schedule. It's really important, especially before going into clinical, that you review your immunization, or you review your injection procedures. Our babies, we inject in the vastus lateralis, so we're injecting it in the thigh, the middle third of the thigh. Review that. Older kids, like 3 and up, a lot of times we're doing them in the in their deltoid, and instead of 3 finger breadths below the acromion process like we do adults, we do 2 finger breadths for our kiddos, depending upon their size. I mean, we've had some great big 14-year-olds that, you know, were the size of grown men. So again, depending upon muscle mass and size, but we do babies in their legs, and babies are a lot easier than big kids. Contraindications, those are listed as well. Anaphylactic or systemic allergic reaction to the vaccine or a component of the vaccine. Pertussis immunization can cause encephalopathy without an identified cause within 7 days of the vaccine or the immunization. The main thing we need to be concerned with are a lot of times are our parental concerns. Our parents are very, very worried about vaccine safety. And a lot of time they're going to say, well, I'm not going to vaccinate my child because I heard it can cause autism. Autism is a big one. There was a study, a British researcher came out, and he had a study that proved that until it was proved that his research was false. It wasn't, in fact, truth. So, sorry, guys, but a lot of people don't vaccinate for that reason, or there are a number of reasons. There are, we call them anti-vaxxers, and they're very much against vaccination. But you have to, you know, take that into consideration, and we really encourage vaccination. Children in the school system require vaccination. Just saying. If a child has Medicaid, they're required, unless there's a medical reason, they're required to receive their vaccinations. Otherwise, they risk losing their Medicaid. So that's something else. That's a consideration as well. So we have to think about that. So a lot of them some of our parents are very vaccine resistant. So we have to be aware of that. And again, we need to give them information, and we need to hopefully put them in or on the right track or in the right direction. Nursing considerations with vaccination: mild acute illness with low grade fever or mild diarrhea in an otherwise healthy child is not a contraindication to vaccine administration. So if the parent comes in, my child has a runny nose, so we're not getting the vaccine today, it's not a contraindication to receiving your vaccine. Live bacterial or virus vaccines should not be given to the immunocompromised child. They're already immunocompromised. They do not have the ability to fight off, and it can be very, very bad. And that's, of course, there are special circumstances that we don't do that. That is why herd immunity is so important. So if everybody's getting vaccinated and you have one child that's not able to be vaccinated, that child is more likely to be protected because of herd immunity, because the herd majority are vaccinated and that one person is not. So the risk is lessened for them. Anterior lateral thigh in infants and small children, deltoid in older children. I kind of skipped ahead of myself. Advocate for immunization. You're about to be an educated and respected nurse. Make people understand the need, and there is a need. I can't force somebody to get their child a flu vaccine if they don't want to get the flu vaccine. But I can present information and in some instances, perhaps help change that parent's mind. Not always, but again. Additional health supervision topics. The book says anticipatory guidance, which means primary prevention or being proactive in their care. Another one, health supervision, is oral health. And that's my little rant. I can jump off board really quickly because you find that a lot of kids in the hospital, that's one thing we typically forget about because they're not in the hospital as far as like an adult or anything scheduled. They're in the hospital because they're sick or something happened or whatever. But that's one thing that kind of falls along the wayside a lot. And you do even notice it in clinic, you know, kids, when they get their, when they first get teeth, you know, they should be taken to the dentist then. And that's not always the case. But we want to promote oral health care. We want to promote healthy weight. And I've already done my little rant about that. We want to promote healthy activity, personal hygiene, and again, safe sun exposure. We don't think a lot necessarily about sun exposure, but it's something that we should be very mindful of as far as we know long-term damage, and we know the increased risk of skin cancer as they get older. So we do need to be aware of that. So again, health assessment is chapter 32. That's on page 1116. And basically, these are just the steps of health assessment as far as health interview and history, observation of the parent-child interaction, assessment of the child's emotional, cognitive, physiologic, and social development, as well as doing a physical assessment. It's very important as far as our role in health assessment that we try to establish rapport and trust. I said important. I didn't say easy. Sometimes it's not so easy, but it's very important that we do that. We demonstrate respect as we do for any client or patient we're caring for, that we communicate effectively, that we observe systematically, obtain accurate data, and again, that we're using therapeutic communication techniques. We do that with active listening, open-ended questions, and we're again at their level of understanding. And again, you've had growth and development. You had a whole semester on this as far as health assessment, or you had a whole class on health assessment, maybe not so much on kids. But just kind of, you've got your review of systems. You know your review of systems, or if you don't, you should. And we don't want to forget any of those systems. Look at our specifics by age group. That's where we kind of pull away, I guess, a little bit from the norm. Newborn and infant, you would have your caregiver hold the baby. You would listen to their heart and their lungs and the belly, the abdomen, while the baby is quiet. Count the heart rate and respiratory rate before undressing the baby. And again, sometimes this is difficult or more difficult. When they're crying, their heart rate is going to be faster or more rapid. And realize, too, that their heart rate is a lot faster than the adults you're used to listening to. So they're going to be pumping away. So they're a lot harder sometimes to hear when you're doing their heart rate. Was that page 1116? Health assessment, that is the chapter, where the chapter starts is 1116. So, but think about those things. And then the toddler, we want to try to incorporate play into the exam. You can still let them sit in the caregiver's lap, if at all possible, because a lot of times they're going to be more calm. But again, you can still use those distraction techniques. I've got my badge on. It's on a little dealy-dealy. So sometimes they'll grab that. Or I've got a pen light or whatever. So again, incorporate play. A preschooler, they fear body invasion and mutilation. Withdrawal procedure or assessment viewed as intrusive. So, you know, they'll view whatever it is that you're doing as intrusive to them. So if they have that sense of initiative, you know, that's going to help them be more cooperative in what you do. Sometimes it's like, here, I'm just going to do this. I'm putting this on your arm. It's just going to give your arm a great big hug, and it's going to squeeze. Or the stethoscope, you know, you want to listen, you can listen to my heart, whatever. But again, it's just ways that we can do. Our school agers are, again, very concrete. They can be objective and realistic. Privacy and respect for feelings is very important when you're doing their health assessment. And I'm talking a complete health assessment. I'm not talking, you know, just doing vital signs or something like that. So when we're doing a health assessment, we need to make sure we're managing their privacy and we're providing respect. And our adolescents or teenagers, again, head-to-toe approach, limit exposure, attitude of respect, and privacy. So it's just as important that they are assessed as is anybody else. So we can't leave things out. Steps of the physical exam. Again, you've got them listed out. Observation, palpation, percussion, and auscultation. Those should all sound very, very familiar to you. So the next is chapter 33, caring for children in diverse settings. And that is page 1156. I did change the handout. So if you printed it before I changed it, yours might look a little bit different. I went in and added the statement, in general, the major cause of illness for hospitalization is injury from accident. And that is according to the CDC from 2019. So that's a generality. That's what your book says. So don't get it confused. But in general, the major cause cause of illness for hospitalization is injury from accident. Typically, younger children, children younger than 5, they're typically admitted with respiratory disease. I think GI comes in there as well, like the nausea, vomiting, diarrhea as well, the gastric stuff. Older kids, you can have respiratory disease or mental health problems, injuries, and again, GI disorders. And adolescents, problems related to pregnancy and childbearing, mental health, and injury. So it's kind of varied when you think about the majority of hospitalizations for children. But in general, it's as a result of some sort of injury. Though in wintertime, we do typically have, I always tell the students, 'tis the season to be wheezing, and we have a lot of respiratory conditions that take place, and we see those more in the fall and in the winter, and our hospitalizations go up accordingly. The psychological effects of hospitalization on children, again, I listed the specific page numbers. Page 1165 is where it starts. 1160 goes on to like 1173. There's also a box box 33.4, which is in chapter 33, but it talks a little bit about or mentions the psychological effects of hospitalization. It can be anxiety and fear. There's that potential for bodily injury and harm and pain. Separation anxiety is a great big thing. It can be separation from the home, might be separation from the family or the siblings. Older kids, it's separation from their friends. Separation anxiety is great big. Loss of control. Control is an issue. And I always tell the students, so the one thing, if they can't control anything else going on during their hospitalization or during whatever circumstances taking place, they can control a lot of times whether they eat or don't. So sometimes diet can become an issue. Anger, guilt, again, the separation, anxiety, protest, displays crying, agitation, rejection of others, anger, inconsolable grief, despair, they're withdrawn and quiet without crying, or they're apathetic, depressed, lack interest, overall feeling of sadness. And then the detachment phase, they use coping mechanisms or display resignation, but not contentment. The greatest risk of separation anxiety in babies, I want to say, is up to like 30 months old. That's when they're kind of like stuck to their parents or stuck to their mama or whatever. And they don't want that separation from them. The other thing, as far as a reaction, a lot of kids will react and they will regress. So they might previously have been potty trained, and then you put them in the hospital, and then all of a sudden they regress to wetting the bed or whatever. Not because they have a condition or a problem related to that, but it's a regress in behavior. Or, I'm just trying to think of some others. There are a lot of different ones, and they just regress in their behavior because of that loss of control and routine and things like that. So we're kind of aware of those. Different methods to promote coping. We can do breathing techniques. We can do distraction techniques, imagery, music. And again, child teaching with child life before we do anything. Techniques to reduce stress. And we talked about a few of these before. Perform nursing care on stuffed animals or dolls. Avoid the use of medical terms that they don't understand. Let them handle some of the equipment if possible. Teach them the steps of the procedure. I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do this. If possible, depending upon age, you might want to show them where they're going to be after they have their procedure. Introduce them to personnel, again, depending upon the circumstances. Let them know the sounds that they're going to hear. Sounds in particular, because we don't think about like the MRI and it's a loud, that clanging, whatever. So a lot of times they put them under sedation to do those types of things. But, you know, give them some of these options if they're available. Utilize our child life specialists that we know they prepare children for procedures. And this is a little bit redundant. They provide activities and events to encourage play and normal growth and development. Unstructured play gives them some control. I know there are a lot of the facilities, Ochsner had one before they moved, and I'm pretty sure they have one over at St. Mary as well. But your pediatric floors typically have child life specialists will also have playrooms. And playrooms are just that. I mean, kids that are contagious or febrile or whatever, there's some conditions where they can't go to the playroom. But the playroom is for them to go and to play. And you don't go into the playroom and do medications or anything else, because play is their safety net. That's their work. But the playroom is their space, and they don't need to feel threatened in their space. So, and play can be very, very therapeutic as well. There are different healthcare settings, outpatient, ambulatory care, physician's office, clinics, urgent care, health departments, medically fragile daycare centers, and we have a couple of them here in town. Caring Hands is one. These children have conditions as a result. They're medically fragile, but they go to the daycare because they're not ill. They just might be on a ventilator, or ventilator is a great big one. They might require medication. There are any number of things, and they might have to go to a medically fragile daycare center. Schools can do this as well. Home health care. So those are all other sites for patient care. Caring for special needs, that's 1193 to 1196 in specific rather than the whole of that chapter, I believe. And special needs kids are those who are at risk, who have or at risk or are at risk, I can't talk, for a chronic physical, developmental, behavioral, or emotional condition. And this is in your handout. Beyond needs generally required for children. Children who have a terminal illness or are otherwise dying. These are our special needs children. So they have issues anyway. Like I said, I know at Caring Hands, we had a couple that were on ventilators. They had Miller-Dieker syndrome, which is a syndrome where they have smooth brains. So their brains, these kiddos, they're growing in everything. They're not able to speak. They're not able to communicate. They're on ventilators. Life expectancy isn't that great, but they're not sick. They don't have a disease or whatever. They just have a chronic physical condition. So they require, for their parents to go to work or to do anything, then they require an area or a facility that can care for them in the daytime so parents are still able to go to work. So, and I love these babies. I'm really sad that because of COVID and all, we can't go and spend a day in their facility. So anyway, impact on the special needs child, the infant can fail to develop a sense of trust and bonding. Toddler may have difficulty developing autonomy. Preschooler may have difficulty achieving that sense of initiative. School-ager can have difficulty achieving industry. And adolescent may have difficulty forming a sense of identity. And if you're not familiar, these are all in growth and development. These are all Erickson's stages of growth and development, trust versus mistrust, etc. The special needs parent can experience a lot of emotions and changes in their lives as a result. They can be overwhelmed with the burdens of continual care, and they can experience fear and anger, sadness and guilt, frustration, or even resentment. These parents went into pregnancy expecting to have a perfect little Gerber baby. And I always use Gerber just because. But they expect to have this little perfect baby that looks like mama and daddy combined, or looks like daddy, or looks like mama. They didn't go into this pregnancy and expect to have a child that was microcephalic or have a child that had Miller-Dieker, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot that they don't expect. A lot of times they feel guilt. We have near drowning kiddos that are in the same situation. Near drowning, which you will talk about this semester, but not right now. Near drowning is when you're submerged in water and you don't drown. You don't die as a result. You're still living after 24 hours. But because of the near drowning, your brain still suffers anoxia. You're still pretty much in most instances in a rather vegetative state as far as, you know, you're nonverbal, you can't communicate, you can't walk, you can't feed yourself, you have to be tube fed, all these types of things. And those parents, when that happens to those parents, a lot of times those parents are very, very guilty. If only I hadn't turned my back and had the baby slip in, or if I only hadn't not been watching the child and the child stepped off into the pool and I didn't know where the child was. Any number of things, but it can cause a lot of guilt. And frustration, resentment, it can cause all those types of things with our parents. Stressors associated with this special needs child, housing situation changes. If they're wheelchair bound, then you have to make allowances for that. Sleep is affected. A lot of these kiddos require care around the clock in some instances. Basic activities of daily living are affected because, again, you have the child at home and you're trying to meet your needs and that child's needs. Medical and technical care must be incorporated into daily life. Family identity and employment may be altered radically. If you think about these are all pretty intuitive. I mean, you would come up with those same types of things. And then again, extended burden of care may affect the health of the caregivers. Some parents decide they just can't do it and turn their baby over to the state. So I know of a couple of instances where that has happened. But again, we can't judge, and we're not going to judge, but it's hard. It's not an easy thing. And when you realize what these parents deal with 24/7, you realize it's a lot sometimes for one or even two people to do and have the job and do everything else. So there's also end of life care and planning, and palliative care. So let's just take, let's not pay attention to that. Okay. Because we do a whole section on death and dying. We talk about end of life care. We talk about some of these things. But again, and I always say, end-of-life care or making a child a DNR is a very, very difficult decision. So the same with do not resuscitate. So let's kind of take end-of-life, palliative, etc. out of this little deal. I give you permission. Give you permission not to even study it. Yay. Because we will discuss that later on in this term. So that'll make it a little bit better. And I've already been a little bit redundant about, I've said child life specialist about 3 or 4 times and the importance of that person. But again, it can't be emphasized enough. Next chapter is chapter 25, and it is key pediatric nursing interventions. There are a lot of different interventions in this chapter. Primary one that I'm concerned with are medication administration, fluid and hydration calculation. This is on page 1212. So, again, it talks about starting an IV. It talks about all kinds of things. And a lot of it is the nice to know for right now. Oral administration is very, very important. I mean, you might pay attention or review the administration memes like oral meds. Giving kids oral meds is different than giving an adult oral meds. If you're having to crush a pill, make sure you measure the amount of fluid you're going to use with that crushed pill. So if you're crushing a pill and mixing it with, say, sterile water to administer to the child via a syringe, then you need to make sure you measure your liquid rather than just pouring it in a cup. Because if you pour it in a cup, even if you pour in 5 cc's, which is a teaspoon, right? So if you pour in 5 cc's, do you realize how big a 5 cc syringe is? So you have to think about, okay, I have this baby or this toddler, and I've got this pill crushed up, and I've got it in whatever I'm diluting it in. I mean, my non-essential food that I'm mixing it in. And how am I going to get it in this child? So please tell me you're going to review that and you're going to think about that. You know the 8 rights of med administration: right med, right patient, right time, right route, right dose, right documentation, right to be educated, and the right to refuse. They keep adding extra rights, but you need to know your rights. I don't care if you're in the clinic or if you're in the hospital, you need to go through, make sure you've got your right med, and make sure you've got your right patient, and make sure you've got your right route. Make sure you've got your right time. So make sure you're correct on all of those types of things. Patient is very, very important as far as with our kids. But make sure all the rights are there and that you're observing those. So if you're going to go give somebody a vaccination, can you tell me your name and your date of birth? Or ask mom to say the name and the date of birth. They might ask what they're getting. You need to be able to tell them what they're getting. So, factors affecting absorption of meds in children: oral meds, they're slower gastric emptying, increased intestinal motility, proportionate larger small intestine surface area. There's a whole bunch of reasons. These are nice to know things, but we're not going to go into this at great. We're not going to put a great deal of focus into these factors that affect it. Know that there are factors that affect it, and that we started out with when we said pediatrics, we're not dealing with little adults or small people or whatever you want to call them. And this is a big part of the reasoning for determining safe dose range. Weigh the child. If the child's weight is in pounds, convert it to kilograms. These are very, very, very important. Convert it to kilograms. So you take their weight, you divide it by 2.2, you come up with their kilograms. Check a drug reference for the safe dose range, 10 to 20 mg per kilogram of body weight, so that you're verifying that you have the right amount and you're in a safe range. Calculate the low, because it'll give you a range from this to this. So calculate your low safe dose, calculate the high safe dose, and make sure your ordered dose is within this range. That's what students a lot of times have trouble with, and they worry about rounding and whatever. So if you have a dosage count problem on an exam, we will tell you round to the nearest tenth. And it's always a good idea not to do any rounding until the very end. Because you can still give tenths, you can still give parts. The same thing with pounds to kilograms. So be careful with your rounding and pay attention to that. Next, you have your fluid hydration calculation. And I've got a little thing that I'm going to go through in regards to a little PowerPoint, and it is posted on Moodle. We're going to talk a little bit about fluid hydration calculation. I seem to talk about this a lot, like over and over and over again. I talk about it with fluid and electrolytes. It's very, very important. And fluid hydration calculation, there's a formula. You do 100 mils per kilogram of body weight for the first 10 kilograms. And that says 1,000 milligrams max. Then you do 50 mils per kg for the next 10 kilograms. So if you have 20 kilogram child, they would receive 1,500 milligrams. 1,000 for the first 10, 50 times 10 for the next one, which is 500 max. And then if they're over 20 kilos, then you do 20 mils per kg for the remainder of the body weight in kilograms. And this is something you will do a lot. You don't think you will. You'll do it a lot because you need to make sure that your IV is kind of going at the right rate, that we have what that child needs for their basic hydration. I'm not talking about increased requirements because, you know, we're bumping them up because they're dehydrated or whatever. We'll talk about dehydration in a minute. Urine output in children, in general, an expected urine output for children and adolescents is 1 to 2 mils per kg per hour. That is also important. So 100 for the first 10, 50 for the next 10, 20 for every kilo after that.
And I think that's in the beginning. That's for the 24-hour period.
Yes, it is for the 24-hour period. Thank you for mentioning that. This is per 24 hours. Like I said, I'm going to pull up that little PowerPoint, and we're going to kind of go through some calculations in a little bit, but we're not going to do that right now. So kind of chuck that back and hold that thought. Chapter 36 deals with pain management, and that's on page 1243 where this chapter starts. Pain is defined different ways. International Association for the Study of Pain defines it as an unpleasant sensory or an emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage. McCaffrey and Passero are of the opinion whatever the person says it is, it is. Existing whenever the person says it does. That is, pain is present when the person says that it is. So if they say they're in pain, pain. Do not think your little bitty kids are coming in the hospital and they're drug seeking. If they say it hurts, it hurts. And it's also considered, pain is considered the fifth vital sign. And we sometimes don't think about that. Classifications, we look at duration. Acute is a rapid onset, varying intensity. Chronic continues past the expected point. It's continuous or intermittent. A lot of people suffer from chronic pain. Again, I don't think we see it so much in our kids. Etiology and source location, that's not my primary concern. So my focus is not necessarily on etiology or source location. You can review that if you kind of forgot that information, but Snell's not going to give you a question that says nociceptive pain is or match the pain to the term or whatever, because those are straight knowledge things. Those are memorization things. And one thing you probably found out in nursing is memorization isn't going to cut it. You have to be able to put two and two together and come up with the appropriate answer. Factors influencing pain in children, and that's page 1247, so that's kind of interesting. Age and gender, their cognitive level, their temperament, previous pain experiences, family and cultural background. Some cultures are much more verbal about pain. Other cultures are much more stoic about pain. So that could be, I saw it, therefore, you know, I'm responding appropriately, or I'm responding how my family responds, et cetera. So it could be a word of something. There are different pediatric pain scales, FLAC, a behavioral scale, and that's a behavioral pain assessment scale used for nonverbal or preverbal patients. These are little patients that can't talk. And they're not able to report or self-report their level of pain. It's addressed through observation of five categories: face, legs, activity, cry, and consolability. So that is FLAC, or what it stands for. FACES, the FACES pain rating scale, is basically you have little pictures of faces. So one face is, there's like no pain because this face is fine. You have one face with a little straight line. So we're trying to get them to identify, or we're identifying based on the little face. There is a neonatal infant pain scale, and it again uses behavioral clues and two physiological variables. They're scored on a 1 to 10 scale in coordination with clinical nursing judgment, facial expression, cry, breathing patterns, arms, legs, state of arousal. And then, of course, there's the 10-point scale on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being the worst pain you've ever experienced and 1 no pain, or very, very minimal, whatever. No pain, I prefer. Where would you say your pain is? So the book lists a whole bunch of different ones. Do you need to know a whole bunch of different ones? No. These are the ones that we typically see in our area hospitals. And of these, I would go with probably FACES and the 10-point scale. You might see some use of FLAC, but or NIPS, but again, not so much where we're going to be. So again, I'm not going to have you describe their pain based on this scale. You need an understanding. When you're assessing your patients in clinical, how do I assess their pain? Pain management, there are non-pharmacologic, and you've studied those before. You know about relaxation and distraction and guided imagery. Sucking and sucrose is the next one that's listed. And they found that infants that suck, like on a pacifier, or if we give them, I'm trying to remember what they're called. There's a little gel that you can just kind of, or little drops that you can just kind of put in their mouth. And that sucrose is soothing to them. And I've looked it up, guys. There's research supporting it. Crazy as that sounds. We can apply heat and cold depending upon the situation and where we're at, when it would be all right to do that. We can do massage and pressure. Those are all non-pharmacologic methods. We can do analgesics. We can do PCAs, local analgesia, epidural, conscious sedation. Those are all things that we will see done, or we will use. PCAs are lovely if they're old enough to understand I push the button when I'm hurting. And again, our role or our part in this is managing procedure-related pain. We can use topical anesthetic at the site of the skin, where they're going to get something. We have some spray we can use, and we can spray the area to kind of numb it. It's that freeze spray. It's very, very cold. So we can use that. There are topical ointments that you can apply, and then go to your IV stick afterwards. There's some different there are some different topical anesthetics that we can use. A lot of times kids even think that, like the freeze spray in particular, that it hurts more to use it. If you've never used it, it just makes your skin way, way cold, almost to the point of hurting. And then they don't feel the injection necessarily as much or whatever. And we can use non-pharmacologic. We can prepare them ahead of time. We can do the therapeutic hugging to secure the child. We can do that. We used to have papoose boards, which look very inhumane, but a papoose board where you've got Velcro straps and you can strap the upper part of the body, you can strap the legs. You can do the same thing with a sheet as far as wrapping them up like a papoose and leaving the limb out that you're going to be working on. Makes it a little bit easier to manage rather than thrashing arms and legs. So you have to think about that. We use the smallest gauge needle that's possible. And a lot of times we'll opt for venipuncture in newborns rather than doing heel sticks. Heel sticks can be painful, and you have to, you know, stick them, like to do the PKU card, you have to stick them pretty good or repeatedly to get enough blood to fill in those five little circles on that deal. So that's foundations.